Hello, welcome to the Let's Get Running podcast. How is the caramel kid?
What? I'm good. What's Sean and Sean saying?
He's doing well. He's looking outside. The sun is shining. He's about to go for a tempo run. His first one for a long time. He's going to enjoy that.
Sweating fat.
Well, I'm so tired these days of the little baby. It's going to be sweat. I don't know what I'm going to be sweating. I don't know how fast I'm going to go, but it's I'm just going to go and enjoy it. But she's good. I'm enjoying playing with little Greta. I've been trying to mix up what music she likes. So we've been playing a little bit. You know about UB40? Played a bit of that to her yesterday.
Did you get a toe wiggle or did she shit herself and say no, she's not like that?
Yeah, she got through it. I've been playing her this morning. Do you know that?
She gone through it.
I've been playing the Oogum Boogum song. I can't remember who did that song. It's an old soul song, quite good. Bit of Eddie Kendricks. Do you know that guy? Intimate Friends.
Music history's bad. What about the Crazy Frog? That's more my level.
I haven't got around to that yet. I'm banned from 90s hip hop. Molly said, "You're not playing that rubbish to her." So yeah.
What about Sweet Like Chocolate?
Shanks and Bigfoot. Yeah, she'd probably like that. I'll play that to her a bit later. But, what have you been up to? You been all right?
What about street grimers like, you know, Shankerman or
Shankerman? Does that exist? Yeah, no. I'll go and play her a bit of Shankerman. Yeah, a bit later. What about you? You've been busy?
So many crazy stuff over Christmas. So basically, obviously, Christmas, everyone's, you know, a little bit tipsy, a little happy.
Yeah.
I'm going along. There's hardly anyone on my bus. And so pull up to a stop and this couple get on. But then they go upstairs and they sit right at the front. And the problem with sitting right at the front, the camera for me to see up the top deck is at the front. So whoever sits at the front, I can see the dimples on their face. Right. And bearing in mind the bus is empty.
Yeah.
So I'm going along. The screen's right above my head, and they start kissing, and I'm like, whoa, not on my bus.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to like break hard when I come to lights, you know, like to make them like slight jog, and then his hands start going wandering.
Oh no!
I'm like, what? And the people are getting on. Yeah. So obviously I've stopped. I've got this massive grin on my face, right?
And did they go upstairs? Did they interrupt then, the intimate occasion?
It went into a couple of stops later because everyone kept sitting downstairs. When someone went upstairs, they got a bit spoofed and they just took it down a notch.
Yeah, thank God for that. Keep your hands to yourselves, people, on public transport. There's a time and a place for all that.
I could barely keep my eyes on the road. You know, it was dangerous driving.
Keep it real on London buses, everybody. Keep your hands to yourself. But hey, so this week we've got a really exciting interview with a real life running legend. That's the right word to say. But she's Olympic silver medalist, Wendy Sly. And we're going to talk to Wendy about her career, including that silver medal she won in Los Angeles. But we're also going to talk to her a bit about 10K, because obviously she was, during her career, she won the 10K Road World Championship. So she was the best 10K runner in the world at that time. So we talked to her a bit about her 10K training. But also we want to talk to you, the listener, about 10K and how we think you can improve your 10K. And we're having a little chat off air. Jermaine, about your 10K. And actually, you are, of the two of us, you are considerably better at 10K than I was. So what was your PB in the end?
My PB was 29:26.
Oh, nice. Well, I'm back at least 40 seconds down the road in 30:14.
Which I don't understand, because I was a pure track runner.
Yeah.
Sean was long distance, man.
Yeah, but I was only long distance when there was mud involved. Yeah. When it was nice and flat and fast, I could not cope with it.
So when you did a 10K, and Sean went round and watered the road to make the conditions worse. But it didn't work, the same thing as cross country,
Yeah, I couldn't quite get the same return off the ground, yeah. So all you fast boys, I hated 10K because it was just hard from the word go. At least with the cross country, you work your way into it and, just suffer through it.
I got all my PBs at one course.
Oh, really? Was it short?
Yeah. I say it was rigged. Basically, it was Chichester.
Oh, yeah.
It's a loop.
Yeah.
So, obviously, a loop 10K is like, it's not like uphill at one. Yeah. So, the first 5K is up flat, up flat, up flat.
Okay, yeah.
Going, and you go for a little bit of council estate, and then you go into the woods, and you know, like onto the fields and the roads.
Yeah.
So it's not that great. But yeah. The last 3K is all downhill.
Really?
Like really steep downhill.
Right, just when you're starting to suffer, I guess.
So basically, if you go out hard, so everyone, we would run even splits. So if you go out hard on the hard, on the, you know, like on the twisty uphill bits,
yeah,
you'll be done by 6 or 7K.
Yeah. Okay.
But then because you're going downhill on the last 3K, your legs just turn over and you end up going the same speed.
Yeah, nice. Okay.
So you proper wing it.
Yeah. Well, what sort of training were you doing, and why do you think you ran such a quick 10K? How good was your build? What do you think is the key to it?
That, like, tempo is definitely key.
Yeah, okay.
So, like, obviously going out, smashing. So I used to do a tempo every week, and obviously just, and then I used to race myself. So yeah. I had, like, this 10K loop I was always trying to do, and then I was sort of I used to get so nervous in the training, trying to beat my old training time.
Okay, yeah. That's interesting, because I'm thinking when I was at my best for cross country, which is also 10K, let's say, well, it's 12K, but similar distance, right? The two things I'd do is I would race myself over a 10K. So I'd do Victoria. If anyone knows East London, I used to do Victoria Park, and I'd do 2.5 laps, and I'd try and just hammer it and see if I could beat it each week. Yeah. And I'd also do like grass loops. I knew in a cross country race I'd be doing 35 minutes of running. So I'd do various intervals with a short rest in between each. So kind of like continuous activity, right? So the jogging, the rest in between would be a jog, not be a, it wouldn't stop. So it'd be three, I mean, let's say 10 times three with a 45 second to a minute recovery, and just try and push without looking at the watch, just try and race those 3 minute intervals each time. And that got you really fit, like not worrying about what bloody time you're running or what, like, you know, what your splits were, just actually going on the grass and just legging it. And I think that helps, doesn't it? Like, not just, you're just pushing as hard as you can.
Well, I had splits down different roads.
All right.
So I knew it, because I basically, it was like a you know, like Snake, the Nokia game.
Yeah.
I used to go up and down the roads in London, because obviously in London, I can't do a massive loop, so I'm not snaking up and down these roads. And each road, I knew that I need to do about 2 minutes. I check my watch at the end of every road, and I used to get really technical. I'd only do it like really late, so I was going running like midnight.
Yeah,
you know, like 11:30, because I knew there'd be no people on the road, there'd be less cars. So I'd be running in the middle of the roads, taking the shortest corner around the bends, jumping. I didn't go as far as jumping over people's gardens, but boy.
But it's getting that like race mentality, isn't it? Because sometimes you can go down the track and you can do all these sessions and stuff, but you're running to a time, or you're running to a set parameter with these road loops and these grass loops and with these tempos. When you are like just trying to race yourself, like you develop more of that, I don't know, killer instincts. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But also, I think sessions, like doing faster stuff.
Yeah.
Tempos are important, but when you do a proper session, like when you run fast, like say doing the strides,
yeah,
when you go back to doing a tempo, it feels like you're jogging.
Yeah. Okay.
Because when you've been doing loads of sessions, you know, when you do a race, the first mile, you feel like you're poodling.
Yeah.
Because you've been doing loads of fast running.
Yeah.
So you do need to run faster than you're going to expect to be running.
Yeah.
Then it mentally, it feels easier.
Yeah. Okay. See, we'll have a little chat to Wendy, but we wanted to do a challenge first. So we are thinking like...
This is in preparation of SmackDown.
This is in preparation for our own... Because me and Jermaine need to get ourselves together, right? We need to get ourselves on. So we need to give ourselves a kick.
This is more Sean bullying me to make sure we're going to win.
Yeah.
So he wants me in half decent.
Okay, so if anyone doesn't know what we're talking about, we've got to try and race Battle of the Podcast in March in a half marathon. So we need to get ourselves started. So what we're going to do is we're going to do a challenge, and you guys can take part. We want everyone to get involved. And we're going to have a little bit of a prize as well, which I'll mention at the end of it. So what we're going to do is we're going to do a 10K challenge. Now, what you've got to do to enter the 10K challenge is you've got to share a social post of this show. So anyone, it could be on Instagram, you could share the story. It could be on Twitter. You can retweet the show. It could be on Facebook. You could share that. So no likes. We don't care about likes. We want shares, right? So you share the show notes. Then you're going to run a 10K this week. And it can be just a 10K. You just go out on Strava, whatever you use, run 10K and note down your time for it. We've then got a month. So before February 10th, you're going to run it again, either the same 10K or a different 10K. It doesn't really matter. And you want to see an improvement. In the meantime, you can go ahead and you can try some of Wendy's sessions she's going to mention. You can try one of those sessions that me and Jermaine are sort of, you know, garbled out there. You can try that. Go out and do it. See if you can improve. Now, it's great if you can do it on Strava. There is a Strava Let's Get Running group. So if you want to join that, go on a Strava, search Let's Get Running, join that Let's Get Running group. Me and Jermaine are going to post our times up there. So, yeah, have a look out.
So basically, well, I'm going to do mine's around Regent's Park.
Okay.
On the outer loop.
Okay.
So if anyone does that, obviously they'll see me up on Strava.
Yeah.
Look near the bottom because it's going to be like 45 minutes.
And we want no sandbagging. We know if people are taking it easy just to try and win this competition, don't do it. Get out there, be honest with yourself. Get out there, run a time, see if you can beat it in a month's time. Now, you can calculate the percentage improvement on the show notes for this episode. Right, so I'll put a little a way of calculating how big your improvement is. Put in your first time, then your second. But the way you enter, as I mentioned again, you enter by sharing one of our social posts. That's an Instagram story, it's a Facebook post, or it is the a Twitter, retweeting a Twitter post. Now, if you want to increase your chances of winning, there's one way you can do that. You can make it a bit competitive. And in your share, when you share the show, you can increase your chances by tagging in a friend and challenging them to a competition or a duel. So we want to see some 10K duels, hashtag 10K duel. Challenge a mate, see if they can do it. Try and calculate improvement. We want to see people racing off against each other, using some of Wendy's advice that she's going to give in a second on the pod, or taking me and Jermaine's advice, and seeing if you can improve. So let's see if you can do it. I'll put all the
and
steps
what
to this.
What is the prize? Why are people doing this?
What
are they going to get?
The prize, Jermaine. You won't believe it when I tell you. Yeah. We're going to give away one of our lovely T-shirts. So one female, one male T-shirt. So get on there. We want to give those away so you can have a nice Let's Get Running T-shirt for you to wear at various events. The same T-shirt that me and Jermaine will wear at the Big Half coming up. So, yeah, do that. And hopefully we'll see some people taking part in our 10K challenge. Nice one. Again, you don't need anyone to challenge. You can just do it on your own. Make sure you log it, you retweet or share that post. And, let's go from there. But let's hear Wendy. Let's see what she's got to say about 10K running. Here she is. So on this week's show, we are talking to Wendy Sly. How are you doing, Wendy?
Yeah, very well, thank you. It's a bright, sunny day, so yeah, life's not too bad.
Perfect. And perfect day for marathon training.
Yeah, well, I was up before it got light this morning doing threshold training, believe it or not. So yeah, I was done and dusty before the sun came up today.
Great. And so you're training for this year's London Marathon. How did that come about?
Well, I'm 60 in November this year, and one of my closest friends shares the same birthday with me but a year before, so she's already turned 60.
Yeah.
And we're looking at some fun things to do during this year.
Yeah.
And one of the things that, you know, I have to say she would certainly say it was my idea was to run London Marathon. I've never run a marathon. I got injured, and in fact, an injury that ended my career around about the time that I would have seriously considered training for one.
Right.
I had another go about 10 years later, and lo and behold, got injured again.
Yeah.
I just thought, well, if I'm going to make it round in halfway decent shape and have the ability to train for it so that I get round in sort of halfway decent shape, then I've got to do it now.
Yeah.
And there's nothing like a big birthday to prompt you into doing something yeah, like running a marathon. And I guess with my past and the fact that the sport's been part of my life for almost 50 years, you know, it was quite important for me to do it, but also to raise money for a charity that in effect gives something back to the sport.
Yeah.
So I'll be giving back something to the sport through the Ron Pickering Memorial Fund.
Oh, okay. And that's quite a long running fund, that. Can you give us some background on it?
The Ron Pickering Memorial Fund was set... Yeah, well, it was set up after Ron's death in 1990 by his wife, Jean.
Hmm.
And it provides grants to young athletes that need a little bit of money to help them through to senior level. Some of the names on the list are pretty amazing, and Mo Farah's on the list, Dina Usher Smith's on the list. Yeah. And they've had grants as young athletes to help them make that very significant transition between junior and senior. I mean, we lose a huge number of athletes in that time frame. Normally, unless they're particularly special, a lot of athletes at that age have very little in the way of funding other than their parents. And it's a difficult time generally, you know, in terms of social pressure, exam pressure, and a little bit of money from a grant such as the Ron Pickering Memorial Fund can make a huge difference. And it's something, you know, I'm acutely aware of. You know, my parents were incredibly supportive, not particularly well off, and a bit of kit or a bit of money towards a warm weather training trip would have been extremely welcome. And if myself and my friend can raise a bit of money to add to the pot that is the Ron Pickering Memorial Fund, then I think it'd be a great way to for us to give something back to a sport that we've both enjoyed and loved most of our lives.
Yeah, and you never know with these guys. No one develops in the same way. So the guys that may not be at the top of the sport when they're juniors, and like you say, not coming across this funding that there is available, perhaps, you know, these guys might develop later in life and become the top athletes. You just, I guess you never know at that stage.
No, and a lot of it is actually sticking with it, you know, and working hard through those tough years. Those are key transitional years, I think.
Yeah.
You know, the kind of 17, 18, 19, 20, where you're growing as a person and you're developing as an athlete. But as I say, you know, there are an awful lot of other pressures as well. And most of, you know, I think the kids that work very hard during those years and are maybe finishing fourth, fifth, sixth, tenth even, can very often be the ones that rise to the top in their early mid-20s.
Yeah, absolutely. So looking back at your progression from a young athlete, when did you know that you were sort of, you know, addicted to running, or you had a talent for it? What was the spark?
Well, I think I loved it, which I think is pretty critical. From quite a young age, and it was very much my social life. You know, being at the athletics club 3 days a week was where I met my friends. But I think probably around 16, I started doing a little bit more, and I finished second in the women's 3As, as it was then, 800 metres for under 17s. And then you kind of think, okay, hang on a minute, you know, I'm second best in the country.
Yeah.
And then I won the national that year or that following winter.
Yeah.
And then you start to realise, I think what I realised during those 16 to 19 years was that, you know, the amount of training I was putting in at that time was being rewarded by good results. And so I kind of realized the hard training good results equation was was fairly significant. And then and by that point it was a massive part of my life. I mean, I went to Loughborough University because of my running, and you know, you start to make key decisions around it, and I think that's when you realize that it's not only a big part of your life, but it's actually controlling your life, I suppose, to a point, you know, and certainly controlling the decisions that you make.
Yeah. And who were you? Obviously, we must have been with a coach and things at that stage. Were you part of a club when you were in your sort of teenage years and moving through to Loughborough?
Yeah. I mean, one of the key elements for me was I had a fantastic training group with Neville Taylor, and they were all pretty good athletes in their own right, you know, ranging from my ex-husband Chris Sly, who was a sub-4-minute miler, to guys that were running sub-4 minutes for 1500, which was absolutely spot on for me, you know, to have guys like that that were kind of around 15 minutes for 5k and sub-4 for 1500. You know, you then knew that you were being pushed all the time, and I trained with a group of about 8 guys through that kind of critical period. And I used to drive down from Loughborough most weekends to do the sessions with them on a Sunday morning.
Yeah.
And you know, I think as you get older, it's less and less important. But certainly as a young athlete, having a great group around you, it keeps that social element intact, and
yeah,
it gives you the camaraderie, I think, that you need.
Yeah, absolutely. And did you find the transition from sort of winning the national and sort of winning medals at a junior level to then making that transition both to being a senior but also to competing on the international circuit, was that difficult? Did you sort of find it tough at that stage?
I think it was probably less difficult than perhaps it is now. I mean, there were no age group transitions, so there was no under 23s. There was very little in the way of under 20s. Yeah. So certainly cross country, you know, at 19 I was running in the world cross country as a senior.
Right. Wow.
And talk about a baptism of fire.
Yeah.
You know, I thought I was quite good until I stood on that start line. You know, so I don't think I placed as much emphasis on it because it wasn't so, I don't know, you just had to get on with it, really.
Right.
You know, you were a senior at 19 and that was it.
Yeah.
You know, you were, I ran at Crystal Palace in the Coca-Cola meeting on a Friday night,
yeah,
you know, as a senior with some of the best athletes, certainly in the UK, if not some of the best athletes in Europe. And, you know, you're suddenly thrown into it and you either sink or swim. And fortunately, I swam. I mean, I got some hard knocks on the way. You realise very quickly that you've got to step your game up. Because if you don't, you're not going to survive.
Yeah.
But I think my expectations from 19 were as a senior. You know, that was it.
Yeah. And in terms of stepping your game, is that in terms of both your mental approach but also your training? Did your training change as you move through the levels?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in an era where, you know, ahead of me were the real toughs of the track. So, you know, Dave Bedford, Ian Stewart, Brendan Foster, Mike McLeod, you know, they were all sort of slightly ahead of me.
Yeah.
You know, Seb Coe, Steve Ovette. And so you knew that they were getting where they were getting by putting in the hard work. And, you know, it was very much out there, the kind of mileage levels that those guys were doing. And and also, of course, you know, we were looking at a European scene that was on the female side that was pretty tough too. So
yeah,
I knew I had to step up my training game.
Yeah.
And the mental game, I think, probably took me a little bit longer. Because at the end of the day, you know, you are quite young.
Yeah.
But you get, you know, say you learn from hard knocks and you learn from experience and you learn because you're becoming more mature.
Mm.
So, yeah, it's a mixture of both things, really. I mean, I think the training sometimes is harder than the mental side, you know, of actually kind of standing on a start line with, you know, people that, in many cases, is sort of 10 years older than you.
Yeah, absolutely. And then a lot of the guys, obviously you mentioned the British guys, a lot of the names are male. Like, it was a different period for female athletes. Like, the longest you competed was over 3,000 over a limit distance. Was there sort of female role models for you? And was it easy as a young female runner? Was a career in athletics a possibility, really?
I mean, I suppose things evolved very differently for me. I mean, I went to university, got a degree.
Yeah.
I got a placement with Barclays Bank. And but my big inspiration at that time was Greta Weitz. I mean, I was extraordinarily lucky to have her in my athletics career. You know, she ran at Bislett, and I was always thankful to get in those races. I broke a couple of British records behind Greta.
Yeah.
But I held her, you know, in such high esteem, you know, watching her demolish a field in the world cross country, you know, was just, it was outstanding to watch.
Yeah.
And so I kind of followed her and looked up to her as I was growing up in the sport, and she was just a few years older than me. So, you know, it was just always that kind of hope was to be like her.
Yeah.
And, but also I think that having got that placement, I went to America,
yeah,
and started to win some money on the roads, and that money then was able to fund my summer.
Right.
So I didn't really think of athletics as a career. I kind of thought of it as, how do I become a full-time athlete, or how can I maintain being a full-time athlete so that I can train as hard as I can, because I want to compete well on the track.
Right,
so that was my thought process, really. Not, I want to earn a load of money. Yeah, it was more like, how can I survive so that I don't have to hold down a job and run twice a day and try and train as hard as everybody else because I want to succeed on the track.
Yeah.
And so it was a completely different way of thinking to, I think, the way people think now. You know, there's a lot of decisions that I made totally based on the fact that I wanted to compete at the highest level on the track.
Right.
If it had been based around money, I probably wouldn't have come home from the States. I would have probably stayed out there and earned as much as I could. It was about succeeding and winning medals at championships and being in finals at championships. That was what was, that's what I was driven by.
Okay.
I was quite a purist in that way. Rightly or wrongly, depending on how you view it.
I guess, like, looking at the situation now for athletes who are trying to sort of find their way, it's a difficult time to. I mean, it's one of those careers where if you decide to go into running, sort of now you're better off not doing it at all and just getting a full time job doing something quite menial, really, than actually following a career in athletics. I guess it's a similar. You've got to have a lot of drive and determination to get out there and find a way to do it. And you can't think of it really as a career in the same way.
No, I think that element is still true now. Mm. I mean, I think if you go into it because you want funding and then you're going to sit back and do nothing, then you're never going to succeed. You know, you've got to still have that innate desire to be successful at the highest level and to, you know, do anything and everything you can to achieve those goals. You know, that element is still true.
I
think, you know, whether you're, you know, I've watched a couple of athletes come through and by sheer determination and taking advantage of as many opportunities as possible and putting everything into it have actually done far better than maybe people would have thought. You know, and equally there are people that are up there that are still doing all those things. So, I think the driving force has to be success at the highest level, you know, not to make a living.
Yeah. And given that sort of the highest level was Olympics and you could only run 3,000 at the longest distance, obviously that's a bit of a, I was going to say, a bit of a hamstring. It wasn't easy. Were you actually suited to 3K? Was that a distance you would have chosen necessarily to race over if you had the possible opportunity?
No, I've run three times under 8:40, so you know I wasn't too bad. But I think I've got some data going back to sort of the late 80s, early 90s, and the great Dr. David Martin's written on his commentary, it's a shame there isn't a 5,000 metres in the Olympics. Because probably all my stats would indicate that I could have run, had I been given the opportunity, to a very good 5K. But there weren't that many. And I think by the time I did run one, it was towards the end of my career and I was struggling a bit. And yeah, so I don't think I ever fulfilled what could have done over 5K. But, you know, but you also have to sort of think to yourself, when I first started watching athletics and being excited by it as a sport, 800 metres was the longest distance.
Really?
In that sense, you know, we've come a long way. And I think it's fantastic to see our female athletes now performing so well at 5K, 10K, marathon. And certainly if I was entering a career in the sport now, I'd probably think about it slightly differently. Just in terms of certainly the event I chose, you know, it would almost certainly be ultimately 10K.
And
and probably a marathon at some point. But, you know, so you make decisions based upon where you are, don't you?
Absolutely, yeah. And obviously you won the World Women's 10K race in 1983. Must have been a pretty amazing experience, really, to be the world champion in a distance.
Yeah. And, you know, at that time I probably was the best at 10K on the road. You know, I beat Greta that year, which was a childhood dream, beating my idol.
What was that like? Do you remember it? Do you remember sort of going past or anything? Or do you remember that experience?
Yeah. I mean, I ran the last mile in something silly like 4:58. I was running with pure fear.
Yeah.
Over 15K as well.
Really?
I was just absolutely petrified she was going to come back. I just couldn't believe that I was in front. It was a turning point mentally, I think, because you then start to believe, don't you? You know, you beat somebody that you've held in such high esteem for such a long time.
Yeah.
And then you start to think, crikey, you know, I'm not too bad at this.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
did you go into the race feeling like you would, you know, the favourite and you could do it, you could win?
What, the World Championships?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. As it turned out, it was an incredibly close finish, but yes, I did. I think even if you don't vocalise it, which I'm sure I didn't, if internally you feel like it's going to be your day, then 9 times out of 10, I think it will be, unless something goes horribly wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. And still being, I think you're the third fastest ever British woman over 10K on the road still. Is it behind Paula and Liz McColgan and Liz Nuttall? Are they only two that have gone faster than you since?
Yeah, I think Gemma Steele might have actually pipped me. When she was, I think she might have pipped me by a couple of seconds. Yes, I think I might have been moved down to fourth.
But I guess
that's not too bad. 36 years.
Yeah, wow. And what do you think made you such a good 10K runner? Like, how did you train for that event particularly?
Well, I didn't.
Right.
I was training for 3K.
Right.
As I say, every single thing I did was around being able to perform on the track at 3K, which at that time was the longest you could do on the track.
Yeah.
And, you know, and track was where I wanted to be, and track at that time was still, you know, the be-all and end-all, and, you know, the marathon hadn't really come into its own in the way perhaps it was 10 years after that.
Yeah.
So I was doing 3K training.
Right.
But also you have to remember that 3K training in those days, you know, I was running 80, 90 miles a week, all at very high tempo. I mean, when you're married to a guy that's a sub-4-minute miler that doesn't give you an inch, you end up running quite hard. And now that had its ups and that had its positives and its negatives, because I think I probably got injured quite a lot.
Yeah.
But, you know, my runs were pretty high paced.
Yeah.
And I could hold my own over 10 miles fairly easily with a group of guys. So, you know, there was something in my training, even though at the time I was always never in my brain was I thinking I'm training for 10K on the road.
Yeah.
I was always thinking I'm training for 3K on the track. There was huge elements of my training that were very suited, I think, to 10K and probably, you know, beyond 10K. I mean, I was doing 12-mile runs and twice a day, most days. And
wow.
As I say, in the kind of 80 and 90 miles a week, training for 3K.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think just inevitably the result of all of that was being able to run fairly quick over 10K.
Yeah. And would you have, based on that experience, would you have like advice for listeners who are training for 10K? What do you think, based on your approach, what do you think is a good strategy for getting the best out of yourself over that distance?
I think the key thing for 10K really is being able to run at pace for a significant amount of time. So I think the kind of tempo threshold training and you know, putting in efforts of 3, 4, 6 minutes with relatively short recovery are the key elements to that type of training. Obviously, you've got to tailor that according to where you are, how old you are, your maximum heart rate, you know, that requires a bit of science, but you know, the component parts where you've got a kind of 3 to 6 minute effort with a relatively short recovery within a run of say 50 minutes, that's pretty key to being able to run a decent 10k, I think, because you know, part of the secret for me running a 10k was always to go through the first mile somewhere between 4:52 and say 4:55, something like that, and then hang on.
Right.
So the ability to hang on comes from that kind of training, I think.
That's
about as much science as I can put behind it.
Set out your stall early and hope for the best. That's good. Well, obviously the following year you finished second in the Olympics 1984. And it's an iconic race, and most people will remember the or will have heard, or if they're not old enough, but they will have heard of the race or remember the race. And going into the event, how did you feel your preparation had gone? Were you feeling confident about your chances in the 3K?
Well, I'd had a funny year, really, because I'd come off the back of a really successful year in 83, because I'd broken the British record twice, I think, and I'd beaten Greta, and I'd won the world 10k on the road, and I'd run one of the fastest 15k's ever, and you know, I'd run a PB 1500 and 800. You know, it was just one of those years, and so I kind of went into 84 thinking, right, well, it's the Olympic year, and here I am, you know, having done all of this, just keep going, moving on. And then I got injured in the spring, and then the whole Zola bug thing kicked off. And I was living in America at the time, and I got a call from a journalist, and I didn't have a clue. My mum very innocently had given the guy my number, and I started getting all these questions about something I had no idea about, because you've got to remember there was no internet, no mobile phones, no social media. So I was completely unaware of all of this. And of course, then I came home, recovered from my injury, getting fit again, and the whole thing just snowballed. So it was, I went from being a sort of relatively unknown but good runner, focused on the Olympics, to having all this noise around me, which was press and TV, and they just wanted to make me out to be the bad person. They wanted some sort of conflict between me and Zola, because that obviously makes good news. And it more or less destroyed me. I mean, I was really ill. I didn't make the trial race. I had a temperature of 102. Just absolutely wiped out. When I did run, I was running really badly, because mentally I was just exhausted. And I went to see a sports psychologist, a guy called Maurice Yaffe.
He's
sadly passed away, who'd written a book on tennis, and called, I think it was called The Winning Game. Anyway, Neville decided that it would be a good idea. And you know, as I say, every decision I made was based around trying to succeed. So I went, right, okay. And out of that, I made the decision to get out of the country and get away from it. So I went to, I ran in the Prefontaine Classic. And I ran something okay-ish, like a sort of 4.6, 4.8 type performance, but it was more me. And I took that, and then I went for 6 weeks and trained in LA. Away from everybody. And I didn't go into the village until about 10 days before. But before that, right before I went into the village, I ran 2.3 for 800 in training.
Wow.
So I knew that I was in good shape. And I went into that village a completely different person to the person that left the UK some 6 weeks before. I just got away from it all. It was, I wasn't a particularly confident or media savvy animal. So I didn't know how to deal with it. And I took a lot of it personally and started to get very down about it. And by getting away from it, I just forgot about it and got on with what I knew best, which was training hard. And I put together a series of good weeks, good training. Neville came out and was able to sort of time that last session. I was due to do 2 400s after the eight, but he's after the eight, just said, right, stop. That's it. You're ready.
Really?
Well, you know, my best was only 2 2.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, I went into that village pretty confident that unless I mucked it up, I should win a medal.
Yeah.
And the heat just emphasised that, really. You know, I was pretty in control in the heat. I felt good. I was running well. And, yeah, you know, I knew it was only going to be my fault if I didn't come back with something.
Yeah, okay. But did you go and think as far as goal? Was that a possibility or...?
I don't know, really. I mean, I think I always knew that Puika was going to be the strong one in the race.
Yeah.
And probably there was a point in the race where I thought, bloody hell, I can nick this.
Yeah.
You know, I probably went a bit too early. But there'd also been a lot gone on.
Yeah, of course. So yeah.
I'm not sure I was thinking straight either. Yeah.
Was it hard to stay focused then? How did you deal with all the stuff that was going on around you?
Well, it's funny because a guy rang me a few years ago writing a book. There's so many people written books about Mary Decker and that race. And and he said to me, he said, I've watched it over and over. And he said, you're the only one that doesn't look sideways.
Really?
And at the time when Mary goes down, I didn't hear him, but Neville shouted, go. And in my mind, I thought, go. Because I was thinking, if she gets up, I've got to be as far away as I can, or she's going to catch us.
Yeah.
And of course, I didn't even realise till the race was over that Mary hadn't got up.
Yeah.
I didn't even look. I was just really focused on trying to drop Zola and Puika, knowing that I probably didn't have the quickest finish in the world. So, yeah, that's kind of where I was, I suppose.
Yeah. And I guess because you were leading coming into the last lap, did you think at that point at the bell, did you think, I can do this? What was your thoughts at that point?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, probably not really maybe having the confidence or the race experience. I kind of thought, I've got to go now. If I don't go now, I'm never going to beat Puika over the last 200. As it happened, she stuck with me and still kicked away from me the last 200. But to give it my best shot, I needed to go fairly early. I needed to go sort of 400 or 500 to go, really.
Yeah.
Which I did. I just couldn't hang on to that pace.
Yeah.
And we had gone out quite quick. The beginning of the race was quite fast, and then it slowed, and then it got very quick again.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think I still ran 8:39 that day.
Yeah. And what was the atmosphere like at that stage? Because with Mary down, and I guess, you know, out of the race, and what was could you hear the crowd, or you just focused on the?
Oh, it was hideous.
Really?
Yeah, it was hideous. Yeah, they were all booing.
Really?
Yeah, it was absolutely awful.
Yeah.
And not how you want to run an Olympic final, quite frankly.
Absolutely not, no.
But you have to put these things out of your mind, you know. One thought that did go through my mind was, oh, my God, I hope we don't have to do this all again.
Oh, really?
Because, big American Olympics, wasn't it? Los Angeles, you know, it's the big commercial games. Mary was the golden girl.
Yeah.
And I just kept thinking, we're going to have to do this all again tomorrow. You don't want to go through all of that. But that did go through my mind for a fleeting second.
Yeah.
Around the top bend. But
fantastic. Yeah. And following the Olympics, what did you think at that point? Did you have ideas of, you know, coming back the following, you know, 4 years' time and going for gold? What did you think? How did you want your career to progress at that stage?
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to... You know, I think when you win a silver, you always want to have the gold, don't you?
Yeah.
I think, unfortunately for me, in Seoul, I should have run the 10K, really.
Mm.
But I was given a bit of an ultimatum by the selectors at that time, which wouldn't happen now. I qualified for both the 10 and the 3.
Yeah.
And they told me I couldn't possibly do both.
Wow.
And I had to choose. and I probably chose the wrong event. And I mean, it was just a very frustrating time, particularly since I think Angela Tooby was injured. One of the two, I think it was Angela, was injured. So didn't really perform. I think she may have even dropped out, but didn't really perform the way she could have at 10K. And I was sat there completely healthy, completely rested from the 3K. But, you know, woulda, coulda, shoulda, you know, those are always things you could, always things you could have done, should have done. But that certainly, for me, you know, British Athletics should have allowed me to do both.
Is the
real answer. But given the fact that they didn't, I should have perhaps chosen the 10. But, you know, hey.
And then sort of the injuries came in later in the career that, that kind of put a stop to any move to any sort of marathon and that sort of thing.
I had a very strange injury, which to this day, I don't really know what it was, but I could, I lost control of my right leg. At pace. So I could do, sessions and get quite fit, but I couldn't maintain pace over any significant distance. And that's why I dropped out of the 10K at Commonwealth Games in Auckland. Because my, you know, I mean, I would do everything. I'd be swinging my arm around, my body around to try and move my leg in front of me, and it just wouldn't go. And it was something to do with the nerve transition, I think. You know, now you'd have an MRI scan, and some people say, oh, that's what the problem is. But of course, you know, back then, those sort of things weren't necessarily possible. And I tried all sorts, you know, I had a couple of operations, I had injections galore, and nothing worked. So, you know, and it gets to the stage where your money's running out. And I got a job in publishing. So then I started another career. And then, of course, you sort of fairly quickly realise if you're going to make it in a career, you can't be mucking about running, particularly if you, if your days are looking numbered. So I had to focus on a career.
But you've remained in athletics, fine, you know. So you're still involved with Britain, and you're still involved as team manager and things. So you're still there. And you had an MBE from the Queen for your services to athletics.
I mean, I had a bit of a, period where I was a bit grumpy with the sport. I think because I didn't really feel that anybody was helping me at all. And then I kind of got fed up, sat on the sofa moaning about the performances and, you know, and everybody can moan, but the best way I felt to help and try and make a difference was getting involved. So I've done a bit of mentoring and done a bit of team management. I've sat on the England board. I've done a whole mixture of bits. nothing significant, but a lot of bits.
And obviously still running, still sort of raising money for Ron Pickering Fund, so which is great.
Well, I mean, I tell you what, it's shown me one thing, because, you know, I've never really stopped running. I just go out the door, hammer out half an hour, jump in the shower, go to work, you know, it's sort of my routine. But this is a massive commitment. And I do feel incredibly amazed at the commitment people show that don't have a running background. I mean, I've run since I was 11 years old. It's part of me. And you get, you know, you kind of realise how much I'm having to do on top of my job and family commitments and all the rest of it. Given, and I've got the ability to do it. You know, you get people that start from nothing. That have a job and family, that put in the miles and the hours and early mornings. I'm enjoying that bit of it. You know, I'm enjoying the challenge of getting myself out of bed at 6 o'clock and getting out of the door. And getting back and sitting at my desk. You know, all of that is a wonderful part of the challenge, but. Yeah, it's another level to what I've been doing for 15 years, probably.
And we just started. It's only January. There's still 3 months to go.
Great advice from Nick Anderson, sort of set a bit program.
Yeah.
And you know, Nike have given me a bit of kit, and Polar have given me a watch to sort of help me be sensible with my pacing. And
yeah,
we've had some wonderful support from people. And you know, we're getting to the stage where we might have just snuck over £1,000.
Great.
Already.
Yeah.
And you know, like my sister says, she's not going anywhere near sponsoring me until I'm injury free in about 6 weeks' time. So, and I perfectly, I understand that.
And will you be documenting the training anywhere? And is there anywhere we can support, or people can sponsor you?
Yeah. So we've got a page on Virgin Money.
Well, we'll put a link up to it as well, so people can come through
our show notes
and sponsor that way.
Thank you.
I've got three quick questions to ask you. We ask all our interviewees, and I've completely forgotten to ask you them, but they're only sort of quick fire ones, and they are: if you could be anywhere running right now, where would it be?
Can I say two places?
Go.
I've got two favourite places in the world. Well, probably, Quinta do Lago in southern Portugal on the Algarve. Absolutely love it there. Visit there two or three times a year to run. And then the other place is Tampa, where I trained, actually where I beat Greta, but where I trained when I was a professional athlete. And I go back every couple of years with my son on a mum-son trip.
Lovely.
And yeah, I'll be there in May.
Lovely.
So in the week after the marathon.
Yeah. All right.
In the US. Yeah, right. Tampa, Florida. Yeah. So Bayshore Boulevard in Tampa.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the most ridiculous surface to run on, but there's just something about it that brings back a lot of memories for me.
Yeah.
Because that's where the Gasparilla 15K was held and where I trained. You know, I used to run along Bayshore Boulevard most days. And it's just beautiful. It's the longest sidewalk in the world. And the bay is just over the balustrade.
Lovely.
So that's a very long answer to that question.
And our second question is, can you recommend us something? It can be anything from books to film, TV show, anything you like.
I suppose one of the best books I've ever read was John McEnroe's autobiography. As a sports person, incredibly successful sports person, had a huge number of challenges in his life, and he's still one of the commentators I like to listen to the most.
Yeah.
So, you know, he was also a sports person in the 1980s in a key time for me as a sports person. So I think we're sort of similar ages, and I found his book incredible.
Yeah.
So that would probably be the book.
Yeah. Excellent. And the third one is what, in your opinion, is the greatest single endurance performance of all time?
Well, it's interesting. I thought about that this morning. I think it's very recent, but I have to say Eliud Kipchoge. And the reason I say that is his 3K split was my personal best. and you know, when you think how hard it was when I ran 8:37, and you think he went through 3K with another 39 to go. In my PB. So I've got a sort of personal relationship with that performance. So I think it has to be Eliud Kipchoge, but I'd have to say Paula Radcliffe pretty closely to that.
Yeah.
Just a stunning performance. And, you know, and then the list goes on. You know, I'm so privileged to have watched Seb Coe run 1:41. You know, I was on the inside of the track.
Wow.
When he ran 1:41 that day.
Yeah.
And that when you see something that close to hand, it's, you know, it's astonishing.
Yeah.
You know, I've also watched Steve Ovett break the mile record, Dave Moorcroft break the 5,000 meter record. You know, he and I warmed up together that day. And, you know, and Gabri Selassie, you know, there has been, and I'm privileged to have seen firsthand so many of them. Mo winning the 10 in 2012.
Yeah.
Been in the stadium to watch those events. And you realise what a truly fantastic sport athletics is. You know, Jess and his Hill running that 800 in 2012, like her life depended on it. You know, those are memories that I'll hang on to for a very long time.
Fantastic. Well, I shouldn't keep you too much longer. We've been chatting for a while, but we're wishing you luck for your marathon training. And thank you. And fingers crossed that you remain injury free and you get there and have a great experience at the end of April and enjoy that. And thanks a lot for joining.
Yeah, well, I think that's the main thing actually, because I'm not going to do much else, so I might as well enjoy it.
So a really fantastic interview there from Wendy. Nice to have her on the show. 10K challenge is there.
What would your tip be?
My tip, I reckon, would be to get out in tempo and to not worry about what times you're running, just to go for a... I guess most people say tempo is like that 7 out of 10 effort. I think, you know, just try and get out there and find something new about yourself. Half an hour, push hard, see what happens. Don't kind of worry too much about what times you're running. Just go out there and kind of almost try and race yourself for a bit. I think that's a good option to boost your performance. Just get out there and run it hard against yourself. Half an hour, do it. Obviously, Wendy's tip was those intervals. So she was saying 3-minute intervals with a minute recovery. So, yeah, up to maybe 30 minutes work with a 10-minute either side. That's 50 minutes, I think she mentioned. And what about you? What do you think?
Yeah, my tip's going to be similar to Wendy's. It's like basically you need to run, do stuff that's faster than your pace that you'll be running your 10K at.
Okay, yeah, so some strides and some stuff like that, you reckon?
A bit longer than a stride, so you need to be doing like, you know, thousands and stuff that are quicker.
So you know that your race pace feels nice and smooth?
Well, yeah, well, the start of the race is always going to feel easier than that you've been training at.
Cracking. Well, look, we haven't got any iTunes reviews for you today because I haven't got my iTunes thing with me. So we have got, though, a couple of Facebook reviews, which I forgot to mention. And also Chris McLean's done one, and he's also been very good at putting in his he gave us last week, we had a resolution show. Chris provided one, and I forgot to read it out, but he's given us a good review. Love the podcast. Makes those long runs a little easier. Listen to some top tips and quality guest interviews with running's great and good. Best of all, you guys keep it real. Provide plenty of laughs along the way. Keep up the good work. So that was nice. And another one from Hannah Turner. Just caught up with all the shows. Great work, White Devil and Caramel Kid. I challenge you to an ultra at 100K in July. I've run it and won it, and I'm considering it next year. Really well organised event with plenty of well-stocked aid stations. Yeah, okay. I think you're on your own there, Hannah. And Achilles, the dog, has shown his dislike of that. Yeah.
Ultra, you know. Damn.
Yeah,
yeah. That might be a step too far. They might need, you know, I might need a bit of mouth to mouth after that one.
I think so. Yeah. I'm all I can think there is your bus story there, Jermaine. Mouth to mouth. Let's move on. So don't forget to get out there, run a 10K. Like, it's just a bit of fun. See if you can take on some of the those sessions and see what difference it makes to you. Obviously, we're not going to turn you into an amazing 10K runner in a month, but it's just a bit of a laugh. So get out there and give it a go, and hopefully you'll see some kind of... Well, certainly you'll enjoy it. So give it a crack. Nice one. All right, Jermaine, we'll leave everyone to it, and we'll catch up on the next show.
All right, see you, people. Bye.
Bye-bye. Yeah,